friend's name is Boca, Salvatore Boca, B-O-C-A.
The French Connection, a millionaire exporter with a record too clean to be true, and Doyle knows it, but he's been known to make mistakes.
Your hunches have backfired before, Doyle.
This time, he can't afford to be wrong.
I know the deal hasn't gone down. I know it hasn't. I can feel it. I'm dead certain.
Last time you're dead certain, we hunt the dead cop.
All right, nobody move. Put your hands in the air.
The stakeout.
Oh, my. It's me. It's me.
The payoff. The chase.
Don't stop. Up.
French Connection.
Gene Hackman and Roy Scheider star in the 1972 winner for Best Picture, The French Connection. Audio described. Saturday night at 7 on Recording Library of West Texas Radio.
Now, here's your forecast for the Midland, Odessa area. It's 53 and clear. Tonight it will be cloudy with a low in the low 50s. Then, tomorrow mostly cloudy with a high in the upper 60s. Tomorrow night, clear with a low in the mid-50s. From the Recording Library of West Texas 24-Hour Weather Center, I'm Maria Lopez.
Welcome to the Western Magazine Hour. Stories and articles about the American West. Produced at the Recording Library of West Texas. Your narrator is Jack.
Hi, this is Jack. I'm reading articles from the April issue of Cowboys and Indians magazine. Here is the cover story for the April issue of Cowboys and Indians. Casey Affleck. The Oscar winner chats about his involvement in bringing the frontier drama The World to Come to screens and the fine acting balance his role required. By Joe Layden. Photography by Robert Linden. At the start of The World to Come, a stealthily compelling period drama about the quiet desperation that can drive men and women to extremes, we are introduced to Abigail, Catherine Waterston, the stoically forlorn wife of Dyer, Casey Affleck, an emotionally withdrawn farmer. Abigail is grieving after the death of their young daughter, a victim of diphtheria, but reveals the depths of her despair only in journal entries that serve as the movie's narration. The water froze on the potatoes as soon as they were washed. With little pride and less hope, we begin the new year. Dyer possibly is every bit as bereft, but he is unwilling to reveal his feelings and incapable of consoling his wife. As he sees it, life simply must go on. Abigail isn't quite so sure. Indeed, Abigail doesn't really begin to display signs of life until she meets Tally, Vanessa Kirby, a newcomer to their isolated area of 1850s upstate New York. Tally is such a bold, brazen life force that Abigail cannot help being drawn, slowly, awkwardly, out of her workday misery. It takes little time for a close friendship to blossom, and just a little while longer for that friendship to evolve into something more intimate. Dyer suspects something is amiss and appears jealous of his wife's confidant, though he would never admit that in a million years, but true to his nature, he refrains from raising serious objections. Unfortunately, Thinny, Christopher Abbott, Tally's brutish and controlling husband, isn't nearly so restrained in his reaction. Subtly, directed by Norwegian-born Mona Fastvold, the sleepwalker, from a terse yet eloquent screenplay by Ron Hansen and Jim Shepard, The World to Come has been a long, gestating labor of love for Casey Affleck, the Oscar-winning actor, for 2016's Manchester by the Sea, whose credits also include Gone Baby Gone, directed by his older brother Ben Affleck, Steven Soderbergh's Ocean's 11 trilogy, The Old Man and the Gun, and The Assassination of Jesse James by the coward Robert Ford. In fact, he came close to directing the indie drama at one point, but turned over the reins to Fastvold, after deciding that a female filmmaker would be better suited for the story. Casey was obviously a part of the package, says Fastfold, but he left it completely up to me, even to whether or not to cast him as Dyer. He was actually a little bit on the fence and was like, oh, maybe you should cast someone else who should seem more like a farmer. But I thought that Casey's sort of natural vulnerability would bring a very interesting layer to the character, and so he agreed to play the part as well as serve as producer. Affleck sat down for a wide-ranging interview before The World to Come had its U.S. premiere at the 2021 Sundance Film Festival. Here are highlights from our conversation, edited for brevity, clarity, and flow. Just how early in the production process did you get involved with The World to Come? Right from the start. A few years back, I did The Assassination of Jesse James by the Coward Robert Ford, which was based on a novel by Ron Hansen, who I think is one of our best living American Western writers. I became friends with him, and so we started talking about trying to find something else to do. He's friends with a writer named Jim Shepherd, and he sent me two of Jim's stories. One was about a Cuban baseball player, and one was about two women on a farm who find each other during a terrible low point in their lives and fall in love. I liked that one a lot. I thought it was a movie. This was around 2006, right? Yes. Ron started developing it, adapting it with Jim Shepherd. Those two guys wrote it about, well, I'd like to say 10 drafts. I mean, they have their day jobs. They both teach at a university, and they did this on the side. Though what they wound up writing is what I think is one of the best scripts that I've ever been able to work on. I really do. And I know the movie is coming out at a time when people aren't, like, lining up in droves to see little tiny movies about such things. But the writing of it is just so fine, so smart. And I think it might be found in the same way that The Assassination of Jesse James was. You know, that movie didn't do very well when it opened. But over the next decade or so, it started to appear on every critic's list in the best movies of the last 100 years. Now it's a kind of beloved classic. I hope the This World to Come will similarly find an audience. It's a very different movie than Jesse James, but the writing is just as beautiful. At one point, weren't you planning to direct The World to Come? Yeah. I was planning on directing it myself the whole time we were working on the script, but then I thought the better of it. I felt like this was a story about these two women, and there was a woman who wanted to direct it, and maybe it was a good opportunity to let her do so, and just be a supporting player. What made you think Mona Fastval was the right woman for the job? Well, she seemed to really love the material. I thought her casting choices, which were entirely her own, were just brilliant and inspired. I thought that it was a hard movie to cast. Catherine Waterston and Vanessa Kirby were really great choices, and that says a lot about a director. At what point did it occur to you, hey, wait a minute, we're going to be going through all of these seasons in this story. What are we going to be able to shoot this? How long are we going to be able to get to shoot it? Those are the million-dollar questions when you start a movie, especially a movie that's not going to have a $100 million budget. I wanted to make it really small. Like, I did a movie called A Ghost Story that David Lowery directed. The budget was about $200,000. To me, it was proof of something that I've always believed, which is the smaller you get, the more nimble you are, and the more you can do. It's the middle ground that's really hard. You can either waste money on giant movies, or you can do tiny movies where you don't have any money. These tiny ones where you don't have any money are just more fun, and you can get a lot more done because you're flexible. Okay, you mentioned David Lowery, who has also directed The Old Man and the Gun. So we have to ask, what was it like working with Robert Redford on that one? You know, maybe you work with someone that famous people always ask, what was so-and-so like? And you always say something like, oh, he's such a nice guy, such a nice gal. But in his case, it really was really true about him. He's just a gentle, beautiful, considerate, humble guy. I mean, more. He's more of a god than a human in movie terms. But really, my takeaway was, boy, that's just one of the nicest guys I ever met. And I wonder how he can stay that way and still have the career that he has had. I really mean it. Getting back to the world to come, what made you decide to shoot in Romania? Like I said, I wanted to be small and nimble and to be able to shoot all four seasons in two shoot periods. Start and stop, start and stop. Vanessa and Catherine are both very successful and busy people, and so they weren't going to be able to come and go like that for over four seasons. So we settled on Romania, in part because it's very, very cheap to shoot there, but also because after the summer, the fall turns to winter pretty quickly, so you can get snow. We did two small shoot periods in the summer and in the early winter. We just tried to get as much snowy weather as we could. Can you think of any specific adjustments you made? Well, I thought that my character, Dyer, was someone who was essentially really loved his wife and was trying to get through a period of mourning the daughter that they had lost and come together as a couple, and that her relationship to Tally was one born out of basically desperate grief. She finds a connection with somebody else and discovers love there. And the movie is this exploration. Where does love come from? But when I got there, I found other people had different ideas about how the relationship between these two women came to be and what it said about my character. So I had to pivot. It's something that I would do every single day on any movie that I care about, really. And I care about most of them. You know, and you're constantly thinking about the way things are going to be and what you're going to bring to the day, and then you have to pivot because it's a team sport. Finally, I'd like to go back to the assassination of Jesse James and the coward Robert Ford. You received Academy Award and Golden Globe nominations for your performance as the man who ultimately killed the legendary outlaw. But you know, Bruce Dern has often talked about dealing with angry John Wayne fans who blamed him for killing the Duke and the Cowboys. Have you ever run into anyone who's still holding a grudge because you killed Brad Pitt? That's just a funny question. No, I never have. I think it's because that movie tried to do something different with the Western. They took on one of the bigger icons of the Outlaw West, Jesse James, and said, look at this. Here's a guy who was made famous by these dime novels of the period that are mostly written and read in the Northeast by people who have never been robbed by Jesse James, and who had never had a family member shot by Jesse James, and who had never lost their fortune because Jesse James stole it callously and beat them within an inch of their life with the handle of a gun. They didn't have any experience, so they glorified, they glamorized. They sexed up Jesse James in those little dime books. The movie was saying, look at what this person really was. Let's reimagine the idea of the outlaw, and without disparaging him or sort of flattening it into some message movie, and ask, what was this person really like? And what was this young kid like, the one who shot him? Is he really the villain? Like, who do we want to think of as the villain here? This young kid? Robert Ford had the courage to do what the Pinkertons or anybody else couldn't really bring themselves to do, which is to catch and kill a serial killer. Because basically, Jesse James was just a serial killer. He had killed that many people. So who do we want to think of as a hero in this situation? The movie actually presents Robert Ford in a very sympathetic way and takes a very pretty, compassionate look at his life. The last quarter of the movie, I think it leaves the audience feeling like, wow, this kid had a lot of grit, man. He took on somebody who was absolutely terrifying. I think it leaves you feeling like, not hating him, but sort of with your mind changed about who Jesse James was and who this guy was. So, to answer your question, no one says to me, oh, You're the son of a bitch that killed Jesse James. Usually all they say is, man, that movie broke my heart. Postcards from a Western road trip. How we drove 3,500 miles through 8 states and visited 5 national parks, 6 national forests, and a state park with only 6 days to plan. By Jonathan Furr. Photography by Jasmine M. Lehman. With little warning, my wife ended up with 2 weeks of vacation to use immediately. So, in the middle of August, she decided it was high time we visited Yellowstone National Park. We'd never been. Didn't know much about the park other than what Kim Burns had taught us. Do we camp? Do we rent a cabin? We had no idea what we were doing, but opened up a map and dove in. We decided to look for a hotel in West Yellowstone, Montana, that sits on the western entrance of the park. Then, looking at the map, we saw that Yellowstone, West Yellowstone, sat conveniently right on top of Grand Teton National Park. So we booked 2 nights at a ranch near the southern entrance. We intended to get back home to Texas on a different route, one that would take us on a path through Moab, Utah, where we could see another 2 national parks, Arches and Canyonlands. We also decided we wanted to check off a few more states on our road trip, so we left the Grand Tetons heading southwest through Idaho and stopped by the Great Salt Lake for a quick float on our way to Moab. We had friends in Albuquerque we could stay with and visited Mesa Verde National Park on the way there. Before we knew it, we'd traversed 8 states, visited 5 national parks, and driven through several national forests. Had we known it was that easy to wing it, we wouldn't have waited so long in life to see the most beautiful and awe-inspiring land our country has to offer. I'd grown up learning about the parks as a conservation story, the beauty always read to me as an added benefit of preserving the wildlife and water sources and trees, etc. It wasn't until we were standing there that we understood it was the unadulterated glory of the landscape that caused great people to want to preserve it. The beauty is always the first and last part of this story. Yellowstone. The first place I'd ever actually experienced something breathtaking. In past travels to museums, beautiful pieces of art have certainly moved me, but it wasn't until we walked up to the ledge of a cliff and looked down at the lower falls of Yellowstone that I truly lost my breath. More than once we learned the lesson that if you think what you're looking at is amazing, just drive around the bend. It always gets better at Yellowstone. Driving on the Grand Loop Road on our way from Canyon Village to Lake Yellowstone, we came across a herd of bison on the horizon kicking up dust and just generally being bison. We backed our truck into a lookout spot, dropped the tailgate, and ate our lunch, watching the swarm of little black dots several hundred yards away. We got back in the truck to continue on to the lake and literally drove around the bend to find another herd half the distance closer to us, meandering across the Yellowstone River. We watched them for another 10 minutes, thinking, okay, we really need to go. Then, around another bend, there were another several bison standing less than 50 yards from us. We threw our hands up, frustrated that we'd spent 30 minutes watching little black dots and counting ourselves lucky, when all we had to do was keep going. On our way back from the lake on the same route, we came across one of those herds. This time, they were 5 feet from the road. Park tip. We had zero knowledge of the park before entering, but feel like we saw quite a lot by dividing the duties. My wife would take the map you're given when entering the park the first time and start looking up sites, trails, and attractions, and navigate while I drove us to the locations. Between the animals, traffic, steep grades, and turns in the roads, Your driver is going to want complete focus at all times. Grand Tetons. We settled for two nights at Heart Six Ranch on Buffalo Valley Road. They have covered wagons you can stay in. We opted for the cabin. This was the first place I've stayed in a couple of decades that didn't have a television set anywhere. It was marvelous. In the summer, they offer guided river float trips and horseback rides over mountains. In the winter, they offer dog sledding, snowmobiling, and hunting. But the special thing about this park, compared with Yellowstone, is that the whole focus and point of the park is the Grand Tetons. It feels less stressful wondering if you're doing what you should be doing or seeing what you should be seeing, because almost everywhere you step, you have a gorgeous view of a magnificent mountain range. Park tip: go swimming in Jackson Lake. I doubt you'll ever swim in water with a better view anywhere inside this country. Warning: even in the height of summer, this lake is extremely cold. This was the second time on the trip I had my breath stripped from me. Great Salt Lake. Very glad we saw it. Very glad we floated. It's a completely different experience than I anticipated. Prepare for offsetting sulfuric smells, though. And there are little alien insect larvae floating in every square inch of the water that will come to life when touched. It took three showers, and I was still cleaning salt out of my ears. Arches National Park. My idea of natural beauty is forested hillsides with mountains and streams and lakes. You would think, after seeing all of that in Yellowstone and Grand Teton, that my brain would be content. Then we drove into Arches, and my mind was blown. Even to this day, I can't say which park was my favorite. Because of the layered, striated, water-torn, wind-blown, sun-baked rock formations, every 10 paces or so is a new view. I'm not joking. We would see a breathtaking view, stop, soak it in, take a long panoramic photograph, and start walking. Then I'd look up again after just a minute of walking and see a completely different scene. It was the same rocks and cliffs. My mind knows this, but it looked completely different. I was reminded of the stories you hear of hikers getting completely lost in the forests of the Pacific Northwest after only walking for a few hundred yards. You think you know where you are, but the view changes so drastically, so quickly. Park tip: this place is small enough that you could see the majority of all of the major formations in one day, but intriguing enough you could spend an entire week. And it features the best entrance to drive out of all the parks we saw. Canyonlands. We snuck this in the same day we did Arches, so by the time we hit our first trail, we already had 25,000 steps for the day and had been in the sun for 9 hours. So we drove as far as Mesa Arch, did the mile round trip trek, took a bunch of pictures, and headed back. But we managed in one photo to capture an arch, a giant cliff, a floor of more cliffs and winding trails and tributaries to the Colorado River, and all of this with Mount Waz and Mount Peel looming on the horizon. We didn't give this one its due.
Hello, this is Michael. I'll be reading articles from True West Magazine. This article is the second part and the conclusion of Escape from San Quentin, Part 2, published April 1999 by William B. Sechrest. Editor's note: in our first installment, March 1999, True West author Sechrest outlined the development of the San Quentin Penitentiary and the many early escapes and attempted escapes. Under the eye of founding warden James Madison Estelle, the most notorious escape occurred in December 1854. After another episode, the embarrassed and politically ruined Estelle sold his contract with the prison to John F. McCauley in May 1857. But the largest escape from San Quentin was yet to come. In September 1857, the San Jose Tribune published some eye-opening data on the penitentiary at Point San Quentin. According to the report of John C. Gordon, superintendent of the state prison, the total number of convicts that escaped from the institution from April 1856 to August 31st, 1857, is 111. Retaken and brought back during the same period, 35. Still at large, 76. The whole number of convicts now in prison is 500. The state prison is supposed to be a place in which convicts can be safely kept, but this is fallacious data, as the figures most conclusively show. These constant escapes were bound to make the guards nervous, and it wasn't surprising when they overreacted. At midday on November 5th, 1857, a group of prisoners were unloading wood from a schooner opposite guard post number 10. When partially unloaded, the boat overseer ordered the convicts to move the craft forward to facilitate their work. As they pushed the boat off from the deck, the guard at post number 10 thought they were attempting an escape. After yelling several times, the guard fired his cannon filled with grape and canister. The slaughter was terrible, three men being killed outright while some six others were wounded. The prisoners stated they had not heard the warnings and were only doing as they had been ordered. Superintendent Gordon seemed to think they must have heard the warnings, but the convicts were confused about whether to obey their overseer or the guard. By the time a coroner's jury was convened on November 13th, two more convicts had died. It was ruled that there was no criminal intent in the killings, and the guard was absolved of any blame. Warden John F. McCauley's reign at San Quentin quickly threatened to outdo even the excesses of James Estelle. Besides pocketing earnings from the brickyard and hiring out his convicts to build roads and work for local farmers, McCauley turned a profit in other ways. Although his lease agreement mandated prisoners be adequately housed, clothed, and fed, an 1859 inspection committee found outrageous violations were taking place. The committee found on the 19th of January, the evening of their arrival at the prison, some 125 prisoners entirely barefoot, and quite a number with nothing more than old gunny sacks or pieces of blankets tied around their feet, none having anything in the shape of socks furnished them by the lessee. The general clothing of the prisoners seems too scant for winter weather, appears to be the last remains of what was worn there by them, now in such a tattered, torn, forbidding, and filthy condition that the commonest street beggars, by comparison, have the appearance of newly Persian-clad gentlemen. The bedding seemed insufficient to protect them from absolute suffering from cold. The cells, being 6 feet by 10, had two shelves on each side, about 2 feet each in width, upon which is kind of a straw mattress, and one coarse, shaggy double blanket. Many of the blankets are torn or partially gone, so that to prevent absolute suffering from the cold, they are compelled to sleep with their day clothing on. The lice being so plentiful as to be seen crawling around the so-called bed and bedding. The stench issuing from the room when opened in the morning will have to be imagined, as a description is impossible. Normally, the proclivity to escape from such a place was an overriding concern of many prisoners. Despite the austerity of the administration, a new brick building, housing more cell blocks, was constructed in late 1858. It was 3 stories high, with 7 cells along each floor on each side. For some reason, a collection of the most desperate convicts in the prison were placed in this new building. Alexander Orlinsky, a notorious burglar, was there, along with Pacing Bill Scott, a robber, Jim Ivey, a horse thief and burglar, and 11 others. Heavy brick walls separated all the cells, and there was no way for the inmates to communicate. Joseph A. Starrett, a burglar doing a 15-year sentence, recalled, "There was little planning to the break that took place on the night of May 21, 1859. My cellmate Lawrence had been unwell for several days owing to the ill treatment received at the hands of the authorities and the scarcity of food, and he was restless and could not sleep. About the hour of midnight, Lawrence awakened me and told me to listen. I did so and heard a slight scratching sound against the wall, which divided us from number six. I remarked that it was a rat. The sound continued, and presently, a small piece of mortar dropped to the floor of our cell. Lawrence whispered that someone was breaking through. In a few moments, a brick was moved, and Lynch, from the other cell, said in a low tone, 'We are going out. Get ready.' That night, the convicts dug through the walls, separating all seven of the cells on that particular floor. By 4 a.m, all the brick partitions had been burrowed through, including the outside wall. A blanket rope was now lowered some 12 feet into an adjoining blacksmith shop. Quickly, the convicts shimmied down to ground level. As a prisoner named Gallagher started his descent, the rope broke, sending him crashing to the ground. Another rope was prepared, and soon all were out of the building and into the prison yard. Orlinsky, Ivy, and several others had been first out, and the second group found where they had placed a long plank against the outside wall. Once on top of the wall, no sentries could be seen, and they spotted a rope tied to a sentry box. All dropped quickly to the ground and ran for the safety of the hills. Orlinsky's group had disappeared, but the second group, six convicts, stuck together for a time. They halted near a farmhouse, and convicts Bowman and Douglas volunteered to try and obtain an axe to cut their shackles. When the two never returned, the others debated what to do. When Tom Lynch thought he saw a light at the prison, he and a convict named Thompson took off running, leaving Joe Starrett and Pacing Bill to themselves. "Starrett had got separated from his chum Lawrence," commented Pacing Bill, "and I had lost my cellmate Bowman, so we agreed to stand by each other to the last. Starrett could walk much faster than I could, and might have left me if he wished, but he would not desert me. We kept on toward the base of the mountain. After several close calls with searching guards, the two convicts managed to steal a boat and made their way across the bay to San Francisco. The two were desperately hungry by now. It was Tuesday morning, and their last meal had been Saturday at the prison. While deliberating their next move in a San Francisco alley, the convicts were seized by a group of suspicious citizens and turned over to the police. They were glad to get a good meal at the station house, but were not anxious to return to prison, knowing what was in store for them. Of the 14 convicts who escaped that night, seven were recaptured. Tom Lynch was abandoned and died when he couldn't keep up, but the rest made good their escape. McCauley ran a large display ad in the San Francisco Herald listing names and descriptions of the escaped convicts and offering $100 for each upon their delivery at the state prison. No one went out of their way to capture anyone, however, since McCauley had already stated he would pay no more rewards for escaped prisoners. As for tunneling out of the cells and the building, Pacing Bill Scott commented, "As I looked at the work we had accomplished in a few hours, I could hardly realize it. It was like a dream. But the partition walls of the cells were miserably constructed. The mortar was soft and made of bad lime. I could scrape it out with my finger. The man who superintended that work ought to have been the first one confined in the cells." And this was no spiteful remark of a convict trying to cause trouble. Joseph O'Connor, the contractor, anxious to distance himself from such charges, blamed the prison authorities, noting that the walls were damp and green, not having had sufficient time for the work to set or the mortar to take bond. In fact, the building was erected in the depth of winter and in the rainy season. O'Connor further accused officials of allowing the cell partition walls to be only a foot thick when plans called for 16 inches. The building walls, too, were only 2 feet thick, while the plans called for 3-foot dimensions. It was yet another indication of prison authorities' neglect of their responsibilities. Another break was quick to follow. On the afternoon of June 25, 1859, the lower gate was opened, and the brickyard crew, mostly short-term Mexicans and Indians, were being counted out by two guards. The brickyard was just across the road from the walls, and just as some 150 convicts had been turned out, a group of about 50 prisoners slammed the gate and seized the two guards as hostages. Prodding guards George Lee and John Spell, ahead with homemade knives, the escaping convicts moved rapidly up the road leading to Corta Madera Creek. Guards on the walls hesitated to shoot because of the hostages. Assuming the brickyard crew were all in on the plot, the guards blazed away at them even as they fell on their knees and screamed that they were not escaping. Cannon and rifle fire killed one man and wounded several others. Under the leadership of a desperado named Francisco Lulio, alias Acapulco, the convicts rushed down with the hostages. Spell could not keep up and was left behind, but Lee was rushed on with his hands tied. They had gotten about 3 miles from the prison when the horse guards swooped down and opened fire. Lulio tried to stab Lee, but caught a shotgun blast in the face and collapsed in a bloody heap. The convicts scattered into the surrounding hills and gulches as the guards began rounding them up. By the end of the day, 3 convicts had been killed and 7 wounded. 9 of the fugitives were retaken, while 28 remained at large. The notorious Tubercio Vasquez made a successful getaway with one Jesus Mendoza, but both were recaptured the following month when they stole some horses in the gold rush country. Lulio's body was carried back to the prison for burial, but he was found to be still alive. He lost an eye, but recovered from his wounds to participate in even more escapes. James Estelle sold his interest in the McCauley contract in January of 1859 and died a few months later. McCauley still fought to maintain his prison empire, which was making him rich at the expense of the prisoners and the state. When he was finally forced out in August 1860, it was with a goodly amount of settlement money from the legislature and loot from his exploitation of his position. His convict charges never learned from him that crime didn't pay. He retired to a Sacramento County farm and made even more money. He died in 1896 at the age of 77. The state now had control of the prison, as it should have, maintained critics from the start. The state lieutenant governor was warden, with a board of directors and other safeguards firmly in place. Although private abuses had been traded in for the patronage system, the prison now seemed to have set sail on a steady course. But as might be suspected, the only steady things were chicanery and fraud. Two, penitentiaries would never be a happy place, and the bloody mass escapes continued. Most of the guards and officials had been replaced after Governor Leland Stanford was elected in late 1861. Lieutenant Governor John F. Chellis was ex officio warden, but his deputy pretty much ran the prison. Chellis, a heavy-set politician and sawmill operator, generally visited the prison often enough to keep his $10 a day salary as comfortable as possible. This was outside of his $75 a month salary as a prison director and didn't include his free house, food, and horse allowance. Chellis had just retired to his office after lunch on the afternoon of July 2, 1862. At 12:30, the rear gate was opened, and a group of prisoners began filing out to return to their jobs in the brickyard. As a trustee kept tally of the convicts, 10 of them broke away and ran back into the yard, heading for Chellis's office. There were shouts from guards on the wall, but they couldn't get a bead on the swift-moving prisoners who disappeared into the headquarters building. As the convicts burst into Chellis's office and seized him, other rebels grabbed gatekeeper Cornelius Con Murphy and demanded his keys. Murphy refused and was swinging his ring of keys as a weapon when the others appeared with Chellis in tow. The warden was forced to order Murphy to give up his keys, but he still refused and was beaten and kicked mercilessly before they were taken from him. Another group of convicts streamed into the armory where they hoped to find weapons and the whipping master, Edward Vanderlip. They were disappointed on both counts. Only one loaded pistol was found, while Vanderclip was being hidden in the tailor shop by Mike Brannigan, a Sacramento hack driver and convicted rapist. Bursting through the outer gate with Chellis in tow, the convicts began shouting as they were joined by several hundred other prisoners who had streamed from the workshops and other buildings. "Freedom!" they shouted while making their way toward the nearest guard post. Chellis was compelled to call out for the guard to hold their fire or he would be killed. Guard Tom Watson carefully fired his 6-pound cannon at the approaching mob, aiming for the rear ranks and away from the vicinity of the warden. He was quickly overwhelmed, and both he and his cannon were hurled over an embankment. Prodding Chellis before them with crude knives, the convicts headed for the hills as a trustee named Miller rode to give the alarm in nearby San Rafael. A dozen convicts took advantage of the turmoil to rush to the Brickyard Wharf and seize the sloop Pike County. They cut the lines and pushed off, but it was low tide and the craft hung up on a mudbank. As frantic efforts were made to free the boat, guards opened fire and several convicts toppled into the shallow water. The others quickly surrendered. At the Brevier farmhouse, the main body of convicts demanded bread and milk, then took a horse for Chellis to ride. He refused to do so, however, and the fugitives moved on. Meanwhile, some of the guards had rallied and approached on horseback, picking off several convicts in the rear ranks. Pressing on to the Ross Ranch, about 4 miles from the prison, the convicts and their hostage had no sooner crossed through a muddy slough when Chellis collapsed and refused to go farther. Abandoning him, the convicts moved on, only to be confronted by a mounted sheriff's posse from San Rafael. With guards now rapidly closing in on their rear and the posse confronting them, the convicts quickly scattered and were shot or run down and captured. By 8 o'clock that evening, a long line of dejected prisoners was walking toward the prison. A muster call in the yard indicated some 33 fugitives were still missing. News of the break quickly reached San Francisco, and Governor Stanford ordered out a detachment of Presidio troops to the scene. San Francisco Police Chief Martin Burke, along with Detective Captain Isaiah Lees and a contingent of police officers, reporters, and others, went along with the troops aboard the steamer Clinton. By the time they tied up at the prison wharf, however, the outbreak had been quelled. "I saw the whole thing from a front window," noted convict Charles Mortimer. "I did not join in the escapade because I was a short-timer. Besides, in going from the store to the gate, I would have been a fair mark for half a dozen guards." For the next 2 weeks, the groans and cries of the wounded and dying could be heard day and night. Casualties were truly appalling. 4 convicts had been killed outright, while 3 others died later. 32 wounded filled the prison's small hospital. Many of the undermanned guard staff had fled at the first sign of a break and resigned later as the convicts hooted and called their names. Chellis, too, took his lumps in the press. The San Francisco Herald and Mirror reported that Lieutenant Governor Chellis gives a military reason for his ordering the guards not to fire, as he says that was his base of operations was threatened, his rear in danger of being cut off, and he was compelled to resort to exterior strategy to rescue himself from the painful difficulties of his position. In any case, an era had come to an end. The San Quentin convicts began wearing their famous striped clothes in 1865, making further problems for escaped prisoners. Although there would be many individual escape attempts in the years to come, the last of the big San Quentin prison breaks was history. Here's an article from True West magazine, published July 2001. Aunt Sally, she cooked for Custer. Aunt Sally, first woman in the Black Hills. That's all it says on her simple, rough wood headboard that now hangs in the Adams Museum in Deadwood. A new marker was erected in 1934 at her grave in the old Vinegar Hill Cemetery, high on the wooded hill above the once bustling mining town of Galena. It says, Aunt Sally, Sarah Campbell, colored, died 1887. As a member of the Custer expedition to the Black Hills in 1874, she ventured with the vanguard of civilization, 1874, erected by her friend and neighbor, 1934. Sarah Campbell truly found herself the vanguard of civilization as she entered the Black Hills with the Custer expedition in 1874. No non-Indian woman predated her entry. Cook and prospector on the expedition and pioneer of the Black Hills, Aunt Sally holds a memorable place in the frontier history of Dakota, in Western women's history, and in African American history. Her rightful place is inadequately chronicled, eclipsed by another woman, Annie Talent, a white woman, whose illicit venture into the Black Hills, illegally prospecting for gold, followed Aunt Sally by 6 months. Though Talent came to be celebrated as the region's most distinguished pioneer woman for over a century, recent acknowledgement of Talent's flawed character has marred her position. The cloak of honor now falls rightfully to Sarah Campbell. It was the summer of 1874, and Sarah Campbell, affectionately called Aunt Sally by the troops of the 7th Cavalry, was a member of Lieutenant Colonel George A. Custer's expedition to the Black Hills of Dakota. The former slave, Kentucky-born, was a camp cook on that expedition of over 1,000 men. Riding in a covered wagon loaded with rattling pots and pans, Aunt Sally was indeed on an epic adventure that was pivotal to opening the Black Hills to frontier expansion. Sources differ regarding precisely for whom Aunt Sally cooked on this expedition. Some say she cooked for Captain Miles Keogh. Some say for Colonel Custer himself. Others say she worked for the regiment's sutler John Smith. Charles Wendoff, the last living white survivor of the Little Bighorn with Reno's command, and Dan Newell, a trooper with Custer in 1874, insisted that Aunt Sally cooked for Captain Keogh. Keogh, they said, was a southern gentleman of means and obtained Aunt Sally in the South. Aunt Sally would use her frying pan on any trooper who got fresh with her and was highly respected. If a man claimed he served with Custer in 74, Newell and Wendoff would challenge him. Who was the woman in the expedition? If the answer was not Aunt Sally, well, he was a liar. Everybody in that expedition knew Aunt Sally. But the two old soldiers were confused when they were interviewed 50 years later. Aunt Sally did not cook for Keogh in the Black Hills. He was not even present. Keogh left Fort Totten April 6th on a 7-month furlough and spent most of 1874 in his native Ireland. No, he was not a Southerner, returning in November. Nor was Aunt Sally Custer's cook. Johnson, our new colored cook, had hot biscuits, and this morning, hot cakes and biscuits, wrote Custer to his wife Libby July 3rd, the day after departing Fort Lincoln. On July 15th, Custer wrote, "Our mess is a gratifying success. Johnson is not only an excellent cook, but is also very prompt." It was Custer's custom to use female cooks, often bringing them on campaigns. Eliza Denison Brown during the Civil War, Susan Elizabeth Eliza Tinsley Mundy at Fort Leavenworth, and sisters Mary and Marie Adams at Fort Lincoln. Custer brought Mary on the 1873 Yellowstone campaign. Historian John Mannion identifies Johnson as Nancy Mucks Johnson, later Millet, a cousin of the Adams women. A 1922 document describes Nancy Millett as a colored cook then living in Bismarck, a relative of Mary Adams, who came to Fort Lincoln to work for Lieutenant Calhoun. Johnson could very well be Nancy Johnson, the second woman on Custer's expedition. This indeed contradicts traditional Black Hills history, which maintains that Aunt Sally was the sole woman on the expedition. This does not diminish, however, Aunt Sally's position as the first non-Indian woman who entered the Black Hills and settled there as a pioneer. Aunt Sally neither cooked for Custer nor Keogh. She cooked for sutler John Smith, in accord with the Black Hills Daily Times of 1880. She is often quoted as calling herself the only white woman that ever saw the Black Hills. Seth Galvin, who knew Aunt Sally when he was a boy, said she called herself a white woman because she was not very literate, and the term white was the only term she knew. She meant civilized. Confusion still prevails, nonetheless, in government records. It is, however, understandable that Sally is not in the military records because civilian employees were not hired by the government and consequently would not appear on the quartermaster's report of persons and articles hired. But contrary to military records, Mary Adams did not accompany Custer to the Black Hills. She remained at Fort Lincoln as Libby's servant. When Custer's returning column appeared, a Custer house orderly went to Mary to tell her the news they had returned. The essential fact remains, Aunt Sally was there, whomever she served, rising at first reveille at 2:35 a.m. to unload the mess gear, build her fire, and prepare breakfast. Life in the 7th Cavalry must have been unlike any experience Sally had ever encountered. The Black Hills abounded in wooded heights, with pure mountain water tasting like ambrosia, a luxurious contrast to the hot and arid alkaline plains below in the vastness of Dakota. Flower-filled meadows flourished. Music filled the air with rousing renditions of Gary Owen and sentimental ballads like The Girl I Left Behind Me. Concerts were given every evening by a 16-piece military band who rode matched white horses, a Custer innovation. When the command entered a park-like area that Custer dubbed Floral Valley, happy soldiers decorated their horses with wildflowers, and the band scrambled up on a ledge to serenade them with old favorites, notes echoing from peak to peak. As Custer's command wound through the pristine reaches of the hills, the 7th in the lead, Aunt Sally, was there riding the crest of its golden moments. Finally, they made permanent camp at French Creek, east of present-day Custer, near Harney Peak, the highest mountain between the Rockies and the Atlantic. When the command moved out from Fort Lincoln, wagons four abreast, it was ostensibly to search for a suitable site for a military post to keep the Indians under control, just in case. In actuality, the government wanted to authenticate the persistent rumors of gold in the Black Hills. The expedition's miners, Horatio Ross and William McKay, had gold panned since entering the Black Hills, finding specks here and there. Now at French Creek on July 30th, Ross made his historic discovery. Indeed, there was gold in the Black Hills. Everyone tried prospecting, including Aunt Sally, who staked out her claim, number 7 below Discovery. The first mining company in the Black Hills formed around a campfire amidst a cluster of wagons on French Creek. August 5th, 5 days after the discovery that would dramatically impact the course of Western expansion, observing the law, they authorized officers and a board of directors and posted a notice on the claim inside the cover of a hardtack box. District number 1, Custer Park Mining Company, Custer's Gulch, Black Hills, August 5th, 1874. Notice is hereby given that we, the undersigned claimants, do claim 4,000 feet commencing at number 8 above and running down to number 12 below Discovery for mining purposes, and intend to work the same as soon as peaceable possession can be had of this portion of Dakota Territory by the general government. listed on the historic document, claiming number 7 below Discovery, is the name Sarah Campbell. The Custer County records still contain Aunt Sally's claim to number 7. Jimmy Calhoun's diary states, Ross was given the first 400 feet designated as Discovery. Claim number 7 below Discovery belonged to Aunt Sally, sutler John W. Smith's Negro cook. Sally's real name was Sarah Campbell, a woman Curtis, the correspondent, described as a huge mountain of dusky flesh. It seems Aunt Sally was up to her elbows in a gold strike. Aunt Sally traveled back to Fort Lincoln with the expedition, August 30th, resolving to return to the Black Hills. William Curtis, 23-year-old star reporter for the Chicago Inter-Ocean and the New York World, published his interview with Sally in the Inter-Ocean, August 27, 1874. The most excited contestant in this chase after fortune was Aunt Sally, the sutler's colored cook. She is an old frontiersman, as it were, having been up and down the Missouri ever since its muddy water was broken by a paddle wheel, and having accumulated quite a little property, had settled down in Bismarck to ease and luxury. Money didn't done bring dis child out hair. Now, I tells you dat, dis ain't no common nigger, and ye wouldn't cotch dis gal totin chuck out hair now. I tells ye, if it hadn't been for seeing dese here Black Hills dat Custer fetched us to, I's heard about dese here hills long before Custer did. Was on the Missouri, cooked on first boat that ever run up that stream. But I wanted to see these Black Hills, and they ain't no blacker than I am, and I'm no African. Now, you just bet I ain't. I'm one of your common herd. She scratched gravel and staked out her claim, wrote Curtis, and says she's coming here as soon as anybody. Aunt Sally vowed to return, and return she did. Sally literally walked back to the hills beside an ox-drawn wagon. She filed a claim at Elk Creek and lived on a small ranch there. She prospected, cooked, and midwifed at Crook City and Galena, where she lived her final years, its most famous residence. Once a bustling silver mining town in a gulch beside Bear Butte Creek, Galena had many civilized amenities, a sawmill, smelter, narrow-gauge passenger train, 4 stores, 3 butcher shops, drinking establishments, and an opera house. Yet, it was still a virgin land with fierce predators, and mountain lions occasionally came prowling into town. A well-beloved figure in the hills, Aunt Sally frequently rode in civic parades at annual celebrations. Pipe-smoking Aunt Sally particularly enjoyed telling colorful anecdotes about the Custer expedition. Puffing on her pipe, her ample sides shaking with merriment, the main character in all her tales was her hero, George Armstrong Custer. She had the reputation of being a good midwife, a superb cook, and a lover of children. Aunt Sally, in fact, adopted little Anthony Herr, or Weir, a hungry, ragged, 10-year-old white orphan boy she found crying on the streets of Deadwood, wrote historian Helen Rosado. He never smiled, so she called him Sad. But historian Mildred Fielder relates a different version. Anthony Weir was 17 and not feeling very well when he stopped in a bar at Crook City, gulped the whiskey, and slid to the floor unconscious. Obviously very ill, he was taken to Aunt Sally's cabin, where she cared for him with mountain herbs and cured his typhoid fever. In gratitude, he promised Aunt Sally he would give her a home as long as I live. They lived as a family from then on, eventually settling in Galena. When Sarah Campbell died, the April 13, 1888, Deadwood Daily Pioneer said, everybody knew her, everybody liked her, and not a few will learn with deep regret that death has claimed her. The Pioneer said her years numbered over 73. She was actually about 64, but the Deadwood obituaries were never too exact. Aunt Sally now rests in the old Vinegar Hill Cemetery under the tall ponderosa pines at the top of the obscure trail that leads up from the ravine behind Galena. There is a new marker now, erected recently by another friend, a Rapid City businessman. The wooden bridge across the ravine below was washed away by heavy floods one spring, but her grave is still well cared for. Aunt Sally is still fondly remembered, her legend restored, as the first pioneer of the Black Hills.
Thank you for joining us for the Western Magazine Hour. Stories and articles about the American West. Your narrator has been Jack. You can hear this program on Recording Library of West Texas Radio and on demand with your computer or favorite mobile device at recordinglibrary.org.
Next on Recording Library of West Texas Radio, the Noon Book Hour, followed by Eyes on Success at 1.
Now, here's your forecast for the Midland-Odessa area. It's 56 and clear. Tonight it will be cloudy with a low in the low 50s. Then, tomorrow mostly cloudy with a high in the upper 60s. Tomorrow night clear with a low in the mid-50s. From the Recording Library of West Texas 24-Hour Weather Center, I'm Maria Lopez.
This is the Recording Library of West Texas.